morning. We'll open the meeting. It's the North Dakota Public Service Commission, 10 a.m., Wednesday, June 8th, 2011. We're in the North Dakota Public Service Commission hearing room here in the 12th floor of the state capitol in Bismarck, North Dakota. First, greetings and welcome to everyone who is here. I'll turn to my fellow commissioners who are here as well for any opening comments.
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning and welcome.
Move passage of items on the consent agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Moving to items in my portfolio. TC1, I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, issuing certificate of site compatibility number 23 to an Exco Development Corporation to authorize construction of its proposed 150-megawatt Maricourt wind power project in Dickey and McIntosh counties of North Dakota, case number PU-08-932.
Second.
This is a case I know that has received a fair amount of attention related to the Maricourt Wind Power Project. The final in a series of hearings, I guess, that we held on the matter was properly noticed and held just a couple of weeks ago in Ellendale, North Dakota. Or, excuse me, this one was held in Ashley. The associated transmission line was held in Ellendale on the same time. At the same time, in most respects, from a siting standpoint, this is a fairly standard and straightforward case. There were some issues that were related to wildlife that I'll just walk through, because if there was anything that was a little bit unique about this project, it was in related to wildlife issues. Basically, all the assessments that were need to be done were done by an Exco. There were some questions that were raised about the whooping crane, basically, and the piping plover by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, especially at earlier stages of this project. But those matters have seemed to have been cleared up and taken care of to the satisfaction of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Basically, with the piping plover, you had a kind of a unique circumstance arise that we have not seen yet in a sighting case, and the habitat in this area is really no different than in any other wind farm of North Dakota, and piping plover has not particularly come up as a concern. This may be something new that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has identified. There didn't appear to be any piping plovers that had ever been there. Didn't appear to be lots of habitat that was necessarily conducive to piping plover. It came down to a situation of, in theory, there could be at some point the type of habitat that might support it. This created a little bit of an interesting dilemma for an Exco, but they have worked through it by basically finding ways keep these straight, because there's a little bit different way of dealing with each one. With the piping plover, they'll be conducting a site-specific habitat conservation plan and will apply for an incidental take permit for the piping plover, which is when there's not an established record of any species available in the area, the way that you deal with it, and that satisfied U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. With the whooping crane, it's a little bit of a separate issue. There was a whooping crane observance, but just one, and it was about 6 miles north of the project area, and it was way back in 1992. Nonetheless, this is within the general area of where whooping cranes do migrate through, and we have a number of wind farms within that particular corridor, in fact, more centrally located in the corridor than this particular project. In that case, NXCO is participating in the regional habitat conservation plan process as recommended by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and with that particular process, the incidental take permit is not needed. So these ways of handling it seem to satisfy the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and satisfy the statute as required by North Dakota law. With regard to cultural resources, things like that, there's nothing really that was exceptional in that regard. And with regard to other things that we look at, like shadow flicker and wind disturbances and so on, noise disturbances and things like that, distances from residences, from roads, from power lines, all of that, all of the general guidelines that the commission has, through precedent, adopted were followed.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Item TC2, I move the commission file the report and recommendation of trustee with district court recommending that the commission's expenses be paid as provided by state law in Verison Hankinson LLC Grain Warehouse Insolvency Case Number GE-09-104.
Second.
This is a case that's been out there for a while. It's related to a license that was issued to Verison on May of 2008. As we're probably all aware, Verison filed for bankruptcy protection Chapter 11 in the District of Delaware. The commission had received two claims with regard to Verison, one just over almost $106,000, the other almost $27,000. Of course, whenever something gets tied up in bankruptcy, it ties the commission's hands to a great deal because the bankruptcy court is basically in charge. Throughout a series of motions, the commission was able to get some flexibility from the bankruptcy court to move forward with this. This motion is a little bit unique in that basically what has happened is the bonding company and the two claimants outside of this proceeding came to their own agreement. And because of that, the two claimants then have sent letters to the commission that have withdrawn their claims. And so the satisfaction of whatever they're owed is between the bonding company and them. We're not giving blessing on that. We're not privy to that necessarily. It just is what it is. They have withdrawn their claims from us. That makes the insolvency go away, except for the commission is applying from the bonding company, as is permitted under state law, the ability to recover our expenses incurred, the taxpayers' expenses that were incurred by virtue of processing this case. And that total amounts to just over $3,000. $3,908.83. Yeah, which would $3,908.83, which would be what we're recommending the commission receive for processing the case.
All in favor?
Aye.
TC3, I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent, shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and the citing application to 1 month and assess a filing fee of $80,000 due upon filing an application in case number PU-11-162, Elite Inc.'s proposed 105 megawatt Bison 3 wind project in Oliver and Morton counties of North Dakota.
Second.
We've talked about the Bison projects on a number of occasions in the past and had indicated that this was probably one area of the state that was likely to receive more attention with regard to wind power development, and this is further evidence of that. Bison Power had, of course, sited and built its Bison 1, had previously notified the commission of its Bison 2 wind project on April 6th of this year, and filed a certificate of site compatibility in a separate case. And basically, Minnesota Power is intending to permit the Bison 2 and Bison 3 wind projects separately due to engineering and turbine supply agreement milestones. And so they're bringing now forward this Bison 3 wind project, which is slated to be a 105 megawatt project at a cost of approximately $160 million. This, like the other Bison projects, is expected to feed into the 250 kV DC line that Minnesota Power now has full ownership over. This is in relation to Minnesota Power needing to meet its mandates in the state of Minnesota. The Minnesota PUC has recently approved in the Integrated Resource Plan of Minnesota Power that gave strong consideration to additional wind resources in North Dakota that could benefit their ratepayers there, and specifically they're looking to take advantage of the federal production tax credit, which ends at the year end of 2012. The permitting timeline for this, they would like to receive commission approval by fall of 2011 with construction commencing sometime after that. And Minnesota Power believes that the Bison 3 project is going to fulfill the Minnesota PUC's IRP requirements and approval process.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That ends the items in my portfolio. Commissioner Kalk.
Good morning. Item BK1. I move the commission adopt the order on settlement in Montana Dakota Utility Company's electric rate increase application, case number PU10124.
Second.
Basically, what I want to do is, this is quite a lengthy order. We've also prepared an information sheet just for those in the audience that might want to kind of go through it. What I'm going to do is going to go through the whole entire rate case, and I'm sure there'll be questions as we get to it, and perhaps even another motion might be forthcoming. I think it's important to walk through the steps. So basically, in April of 2010, MDU proposed an increase to increase its rates for electric utility services to provide an additional 15.396303 annual revenue, or 14% over its current rates. In June of that same year, this commission approved an interim rate of approximately 7.04%, which would have resulted in the average customer of 750 kilowatts, an increase in their bill of about $4.49. So also in that period, we set up on June 16th, the commission issued a notice of hearing and notice of public input sessions for July 12th and 13th, and we scheduled the formal hearings for November 8th of 2010. The questions that were to be answered then is, what is the value of MDU's property used and useful for the services and convenience of the public in North Dakota? What is MDU's rate of return as property used and useful? What is a just and reasonable rate of return for MDU's property? What rates and charges are necessary to provide a just and reasonable rate of return on MDU's property used and useful? And finally, are MDU's proposed rate schedule designed in a manner that will not result in a cause that's just and reasonable to as far as discrimination? We had a variety of interveners in the case. Mr. Roche intervened on behalf of himself. We had Missouri Valley Resource Council intervened with Mr. Skokos, was there. I won't say he was their attorney. He was their representative. He actually didn't have a law degree, but he actually was granted approval to testify or to represent his group in front of the commission. From there, we move forward to, in July of 2010, MDU amended its rate increase application, eliminated the application of Big Stone 2 generation development costs. It should be noted, too, that when MDU filed their request for rate increase, the big investments that they identified were the Cedar Hills and Diamond Willow wind projects, a significant loss of wholesale margins as the primary driver for the rate increase, and they also had a proposed increase, including the recovery of the Big Stone 2 generation development costs. So those were the big things that they laid out is why they needed this rate increase. But in July of that year, the Big Stone 2 part of it was resolved in separate case numbers, case number PU09731 and case number PU09731. So based on that separate case, the rate was amended for MDU to then be $13.3 million. In June of 2010, a settlement agreement between MDU advocacy staff proposed a 10.75% return on equity component of cost of capital. They also recommended an earnings sharing mechanism by which MDU would refund to its customers revenue corresponding to 50% of earnings above a 10.75% return on equity. This proposed agreement would then change the rate from $13.3 million to roughly $11.519 million. At that next step was we conducted the formal hearing in starting November 8th. The hearing was actually scheduled for 2 days. It went to be 4 days, so it was a very thorough hearing. There was also a settlement agreement presented during the hearing, which changed the rate to a proposed 8.739% overall rate of return. And some of the big things that were in that proposed settlement agreement are answered the questions of margin sales, customer deposits, maintenance costs for Big Stone 2 and Coyote generating facilities, transmission and WAPA cost, labor costs, accounting systems. So there was a lot of questions that potentially answered by that first settlement agreement. The November 2010 settlement agreement would further reduce MDU's proposed rate increase from $11.519 million to $10.299 million, so the number keeps sliding down a little bit. Also at the November 8th hearing, MDU testified concerning additional adjustments of investment and expenses related to the wind generation projects. These adjustments further reduced MDU's proposed rate increase from $10 million to $8,825,000. After the November 8th hearing, the parties in the proceeding had several meetings to discuss the possibility of settlement agreements of still unresolved issues that were after the formal hearing. After a variety of meetings, there was another settlement agreement that was submitted that would basically change the amount to a 6.9% for overall cost of an annual return of $7.614 million. The big things that this last settlement agreement solved were the cost of Cedar Hills and Diamond Willow Wind projects, employee compensation, board of director fees and expenses, renewable energy credits, rate design, time of day, and customer bill. You know, speaking for myself, that after we had the hearing, there was a lot of things that were clear in my mind, but this last settlement agreement really answered those questions for me about how we got to the different amounts. So based on that, I've submitted the motion today, and this rate increase request in front of us today, if approved, what this will come down to is the average customer using 750 kilowatts per month. Based on the interim rate, their bill went up about $4.49 a month. Based on this rate, if approved, they'll actually see a decrease from the interim rate of $2.53, which would be an overall increase of $1.96 when we started this rate case. The differences are there's been some changes in rate design since we first started this thing from the beginning. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions, but basically I think that kind of lays out the basis of the rate case.
I don't intend to support the rate case. Instead, I would offer a substitute motion. I move the Commission adopt the order on settlement in Montana Dakota Utilities Company's electric rate increase application, approving the June 16, 2010, November 8, 2010, and March 15, 2011 settlement agreements, excluding the Diamond Willow 1 and Diamond Willow 2 wind projects, case number PU-10-124.
Second.
Thank you. I have several concerns about the settlement agreement between the advocates, the interveners, realizing that one of the interveners did not enter into the settlement agreement or agree to it, and the company in the case, and I'm offering this substitute order for commission consideration. And I understand and have stated, I think previously, that settlements offer some value to ratepayers, mainly in the costs of executing the rate case itself. However, I think we've all come to realize and I think support the idea that pre-hearing settlements are somewhat problematic, and we prefer to, at least in the future, to both hear as well as read all of the testimony and have the opportunity as commissioners and the public, quite frankly, to see the whole case played out in a hearing. So I appreciate that the company and the advocates carried this case out through the hearing. But when information that should have been readily available to the parties was late in coming, some of it only hours before the beginning of the hearing, some amendments, as Commissioner Kolk just alluded to, that were actually offered at the hearing itself, I became concerned about the ability to hear the case in a reasonable time while giving adequate attention to the important details of a case of this magnitude. Information that should have been provided in time for a full vetting prior to the hearing had to be examined during the hearing, which contributed to the need to double the time allotted to the case. I don't think the company should be the only party in a case that has a chance to be prepared for a hearing. And advocate Mike Diller's statement during his testimony that he will move for dismissal before being put in that position again gained great sympathy with me. The contentious nature of advocate's testimony and approach to the hearing seemed appropriate. And while counsel for MDU argued in their briefs that the staff's role is not to be adversarial, I would remind the company that this is a two-way street, that the PSC and its staff is not simply a rubber stamp for utilities. The argument that the company planned and built wind projects not included in the IRP and without seeking an advanced determination of prudence or commission approval was also compelling. The lack of an economic analysis prior to building wind projects is concerning. And while the company responded to these concerns by doing an after-the-fact analysis to determine a delta between low-cost and wind investments, I find it hard to have confidence in that outcome. Doing an economic analysis after an investment decision is made serves only to justify or rationalize the investment rather than seek information to help determine whether the investment should be made in the first place. The chaos that led to a two-day hearing becoming 4 days was not the result of advocates' philosophical leanings, but rather but of the company's lack of planning and cooperation with the staff. The vast differences between the advocacy position and the company's makes me uncomfortable approving a settlement between the two, even with Mr. Diller's recent acknowledgement that he thinks he got all that he can get from the company. But my most fundamental objection to this settlement is not about the tone of the case or the length of the hearing, but rather the inclusion of Diamond Willow cost recovery in North Dakota rates. And that's why my substitute order accepts the reasonableness of the June and November 2010 settlement agreements. It also accepts, albeit reluctantly, the March 2011 settlement agreement with the exception of inclusion of Diamond Willow 1 and Diamond Willow 2. The Diamond Willow Wind Farm is located in Montana and was built specifically and exclusively to comply with the political structure of that state. MDU Exhibit 23 contains the request for proposals that led to the Montana wind investment. The very first paragraph of that RFP states that, quote, MDU desires to incorporate wind-generated energy into its generation portfolio from Montana wind resources. The second paragraph of the RFP states three goals of the project, two of them being, one, support the economy in areas of Montana served by MDU, and purchase of renewable energy at a price that does not increase MDU's cost to serve its customers over that identified in, quote, Montana requirements as codified in Montana code. This level of state-specific compliance of investments in integrated resource planning is clumsy at best. Adding to the clumsiness is the fact that this wind farm was not part of MDU's integrated resource plan. The company did not come to the North Dakota Public Service Commission to seek an advanced determination of prudence before building the Montana wind farm. And while not required, failing to request advanced prudence violates the value of the ADP law, which was introduced and passed at MDU's request only a few short years ago. The company argued during its testimony for the bill and in its application for an ADP in the Big Stone 2 case that a finding of prudence in advance is an essential tool in providing the certainty needed to invest in energy development. I suspect the inclusion of Montana wind farm in this case is simply a symptom of the regulatory rut that tradition sometimes creates. The political climate today, with so many parochial laws and trends, threatens the very point of integrated resource planning and low-cost energy development. If companies are required to meet such specific demands imposed by certain jurisdictions, then it should be the constituents of those jurisdictions that bear the cost. For these reasons, I offer the substitute order. Hope my colleagues comply, but if they do not, it's my intention to vote no on Commissioner Culk's motion.
I intend to vote for the original motion and not the substitute, substantially for the reason I don't think the substitute is in any way legally sustainable. And I think at the end of the day, I feel we have a duty to put forward an order that I think that will be upheld by the courts. I don't think this one would be, and here's why. The standards that the commission has to apply is the facility used? Is it useful to the consumers, and was it obtained in a way that provides a reasonable cost to the consumer? In this case, clearly all three of the projects, and the only differences between the orders are the inclusion or the exclusion of Diamond Willow 1, Diamond Willow 2, excluding them, the two that are in Montana, and both orders would include costs associated with Cedar Hills, which is constructed in North Dakota. It's clear that all three are used. It's clear that all three are useful. And to me, it's clear that all three do so at a cost that is within the zone of reasonableness for what consumers should be expected to pay. When you look at the analysis, it ended up being, if not a low-cost resource, very close to it. And given the substantial benefits that these types of project have in mitigating some volatility and in broadening the portfolio of companies, I think that a credible argument can be made that they're reasonable investments. The problem in doing that is if we were to not include all three in our order and we exclude just the ones in Montana, if you look at the actual data that the commission has available to us, while all three are reasonable projects to be recovered from consumers, actually the two cheapest projects are the Diamond Willow 1 and Diamond Willow 2 projects when costed out on a per kilowatt basis. So the Cedar Hills is actually the most expensive of the three. Now, I still think it's worth inclusion, but I think the courts are going to have a very difficult time looking at an order that says the commission is excluding projects that are used, excluding projects that are useful, and also excluding projects that were less expensive than the one that was built in North Dakota. What it begins to look like is our commission itself taking on some of these parochial interests. I would agree with Commissioner Kramer that these laws that certain legislatures have passed that have caused utility companies to look at projects on state-by-state basis and have really skewed some of the RFP processes, the procurement processes the utility companies make, these are not good laws, and I don't support them. I think utility companies should plan for the greater good of the entire footprint. In this case, however, in spite of the Montana law, it would appear that all three of these are used. They're all three of these are useful. And, in fact, the Diamond Willow projects are just as cost-effective, if not more cost-effective, than the one that would be built in North Dakota. And, therefore, I think if we were to pass an order that only allowed recovery of the North Dakota project, we would have some very legally unsustainable. We'd be on legally unsustainable ground as a commission.
Okay, call for a roll call vote. On the substitute motion, Commissioner Clark.
No.
Commissioner Kramer.
Yes.
Commissioner Kalk.
No.
Go back to the original motion. Also call a roll call vote on the original motion. Commissioner Clark.
Yes.
Commissioner Kramer.
No.
Commissioner Kalk.
Yes.
Original motion carries.
That concludes the items in my portfolio.
Thank you, Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. KC1. I move the commission award a contract to Gary Morlock Construction, Inc. of Bismarck, North Dakota, in the amount of $922,416 for the Columbus Phase 12 Abandoned Mine Lands Reclamation Project.
Second.
There were actually two projects, Phase 11 and Phase 12 of Columbus, that we're going to vote on today, but we're going to take up Phase 12 first. And both were bid openings that were issued on March 3rd for drilling, this one for drilling and pressurized grouting for the Columbus Phase 12 AML project that also involves some backfilling and spoil grading at the abandoned surface mine south of Columbus. That's in Burke County. Of course, competitive sealed bidding procedures were used with appropriate notices to specified registered vendors. The public bid opening occurred on April 14th, and only one responsive bid was received for the project. And that bid, of course, came from Gary Morlock Construction, Inc. of Bismarck in the amount of $1,203,866. The staff estimate for the project was $1 million. Based on the amount of construction funds available for this year's projects and then the overall higher than expected bids for the major construction projects, and that's been not just these two but all of them, the staff decided to eliminate all of the contingency bid items listed in the invitation for bids. That elimination reduced Morlock's bid to $922,416, which is what we're voting on today. We are allowed to award a contract when there's only one bidder if the bidder is responsible and the price is fair and reasonable. And although Morlock's bid was a little higher than the estimate, the division determined that it is a fair and reasonable bid when considering the increase in fuel costs since the first of the year. Also, Morlock has done work with the commission in the past. They have a good record with us. So I recommend that we award the contract to Gary Morlock.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. KC2, I move the commission award a contract to Kern and Tabery, Inc. of Wadena, Minnesota in the amount of $1,731,210.20 for the Columbus Phase 11 Abandoned Mine Lands Reclamation Project.
Second.
Again, same issues. It was the invitation went out on March 3rd. The bid was open on April 14th. This was involved, of course, the backfilling of the high walls and the spoil grading in the mine. After the bid opening, there were two responsive bids that were received for this project, the low bid from Kern and Tabery. The other bid was from Dennis Drews, Inc. of Frazee, Minnesota, in the amount of $3,460,262. The Kern and Tabery bid was $2,245,210. The staff estimate for the project was $1.5 million. based on the amount of construction, the availability of funds, and the overall higher than expected bids, we needed to eliminate all of the contingency bid items that were listed. The elimination of those reduced Kern and Tabery's total bid to $1,731,210.20. The other bid was reduced to roughly $2.5 million. Staff's projected estimate without the contingency was $1,125,250, and again, same standards apply. Although they were higher, staff believes that it was reasonable and within the realm of reason because of, again, of increased fuel prices and whatnot. Kern and Tabery has also done work for the commission in the past, and they currently picked up the ball for us at the Beekler Belva project, as you might recall, after that problems occurred there. So everything seems to be in order.
All in favor?
Aye.
I'm just glad we still can find people to move dirt. That ends items in my portfolio. Actually, I wish there were a whole bunch more available to move dirt. That'd be even better.
Okay, very good. That brings the items that are in the formal agenda to a close. As always, we have upcoming meetings that are listed in our agenda. Our next commission meeting, it's been a couple weeks since our last one, or 3 weeks, I think. But our next commission meeting is Wednesday, June 22nd. We have a few hearings before then, two formal hearings in the Minn Kota Power 345 kV transmission line centered Grand Forks case. The first hearing is at 10 a.m. Northwood High School, Northwood. And the second hearing, remember we're sort of doing this in phases, is the on Friday, June 17th in Carrington at the Chieftain Conference Center, the final one of those three hearings that we're going to be holding that case is until June 24th, just after our next meeting. And that is in Washburn. Also a day after our next meeting on the 23rd, we have the NSP Fargo St. Cloud 345 CapEx transmission line siting case in West Fargo. So a lot of transmission lines that we're in the process of doing hearings over.
And we do have an informal this afternoon after not having one.
that's right. We do have an informal this afternoon related to the construction of the Bridger pipeline. The commission has received some information that we want to follow up on with regard to how that's being constructed, and we just need to get more information from the company. That's at 1:30.
MDU, am I to understand that the rates, the average rate for a 750 kilowatt hour residential consumer is going to go up by $1.96 from where they were before the rate case started?
That's correct. From the original rate, it'll go up $1.96. From the interim rate, it actually is going to go down.
I guess that's what I wanted to focus on. That has to be refunded, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and how long has that interim rate been in effect, please?
That interim rate has been in effect since, what's the date here? June of 2010.
Yeah, I just need to correct something really quick. There won't be a refund in this particular case, I don't believe, because the overall rate increase is the same.
It's slightly different, not much.
Right, but the difference in a 750 kilowatt hour user per month, which is an average user of electricity, that's related to rate design issues. Because the overall rate increase to the company is effectively the same as what the interim increase was. But the per customer impacts are going to be a little different depending on your situation. And the reason for that is under state law, in the interim law, an increase has to be applied according to current rate classes, according to current rate design. Nothing can change in that regard. Once the rate case is done, you have rate design changes. So what's happened in this case is the base rate, the monthly minimum charge, has gone up from $5.50 to $10.64 a month. That has decreased the corresponding energy charges. So for a 750 kilowatt an hour a month user, the actual net impact of all of those things is a decrease from their current interim rate. according to staff, the breakpoint is about 500 kilowatt hours a month. So if you use less than 500 kilowatt hours a month, you probably will see a little bit higher bills than what you've experienced under the interim rates. If you use more than 500 kilowatt hours a month, you'll see a slight decrease in your average bill. But that's all rate design issue. It's not overall interim rate, which is why there won't be refunds.
I'm just trying to figure out, you have, essentially you're going from, if I'm recalling correctly, 11.3, we're going from 15 to 11.5 to 7 point whatever it is, and that it doesn't make sense to me that doesn't result in some kind of refund to the residential customer.
Well, because the interim rate increase was, the interim rate increase that was implemented in June 2010 was $7,617,000.
Okay.
The revenue
and right, and the settlement is $7,614,000. I mean, effectively the same.
Okay, can you give me that figure again for the interim rate?
Sure, $7,617,000.
$7,617,000.
Okay. And the settlement is $7,614,000. So it's.
Okay. I see. Excuse me. And the minimum charge is going up from $5.50 to $10.64.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the reason for the decrease in the bill for a 750 kilowatt customer is that, well, first of all, they are paying a higher monthly minimum, but if I understood you correctly, they're paying less than they would under the interim rate plan for power consumption above 500 kilowatts.
Right. In other words, it's the increase for a 750 kilowatt an hour month user, the increase in base rates is more than offset by the decrease in energy charges.
Okay. So you charge less for electricity, they charge less for electricity, but they charge a lot more just to provide the service.
You put more in the base rates, right. And that's a matter of trying to get rates more closely aligned with costs. Typically, we try to ensure that within reason, and there's always a little bit of subsidy that, not in natural gas, in the Excel system, I guess, but oftentimes utility commissions have subsidized consumer classes in different ways. This tries to get away from a bit of that subsidy, where in an ideal world what you're trying to do is to get fixed costs recovered through fixed charges and variable costs through variable charges, so you don't have customers subsidizing each other. This does not move to a straight fixed cost structure. Far from it, but it gets us a little bit closer to that, so you have less subsidy between consumer classes.
So the $10 plus figure is more in line of what it costs the utility to provide service to that address.
And I think the actual cost is somewhere around $16. I mean, that's distribution costs. That doesn't take into account the transmission costs in addition to that.
Right, because the idea is the same customer call centers, the same wires, basically, the same billing systems, all of those things are the same whether you use 2,000 kilowatt hours a month or 500 kilowatt hours a month. And so in order to prevent subsidies, you're trying to move as many of those into the fixed charges as you can. But even this charge at $10 doesn't recover the full fixed cost of the network. Some of that is getting subsidized through your energy costs.
What would be the cost if there was no subsidy?
I think that was the number
$16
Kevin
per meter
was referring to, yeah.
And when does this order take effect?
Well, effectively, what's the year? Was it August or July?
When is an MDU customer going to start seeing the results of this order in their bill?
I guess that's 30 days that they're going to file their new tariff rates. So, Pat, where's Pat at? Did we figure out the date on that?
It'll be up to the company, but the company has indicated they'd like to file their compliance tariffs within 10 days. The law or rule says that they have to give the commission 30 days notice, so if they file within 10 days, 30 days after that, the rates could go into effect at the earliest.
We're talking about 40 days?
At the earliest, yeah.
As they cycle through their billing.
Right. And it may take MDU more than 10 days. I don't know that, but.
And as far as the wind, can you tell me anything about the Diamond Willow development? How many megawatts?
It's 30 megawatts. Capital cost of about $65 million.
This is for both Diamond Willow? It's
the two phases together.
Okay. And where are they located, please?
Not far from North Dakota.
Extreme southeast. Southeast. The Diamond Willow is extreme southeast Montana, and Cedar Hills is extreme southwest North Dakota. The Cedar Hills is near Rain. The closest town to Diamond Willow is probably either Marmoth or Baker. I don't know which one, but
yeah.
And how much of a development is Cedar Hills, please?
19.5 megawatts.
19.5, and what was that cost?
Well, the total capital cost was $47.4 million for Cedar Hills. Total capital cost for Diamond Willow 1 was $39.4 million. For Diamond Willow 2 was $25.4
million. And I was looking, when I was looking through the order, there's reference to MDU saying that their pension is underfunded, and I was just wondering if, as part of a rate review, whether the Public Service Commission can decide whether it is prudent to include the cost, to let MDU charge ratepayers for the cost of a defined benefit plan.
This is something that I and the commission asked a number of questions about the pension system, because there are great concerns that the two last entities that have pension systems like they do are government and utilities. And the reason is because at the end of the line, there's some sort of consumer that's on the hook to pay for them, that basically has to pay the bill. So we had a lot of questions about the MDU pension system, and there have been changes that have been made both on the bargain and non-bargain side in MDU to try to get it closer to full solvency. It's not in a free fall situation or anything like that yet. It's in what I would sort of call, and from what I ascertained as part of the testimony, it's in the sort of the caution area. It's not in the red light area. It's not fully at where you'd want to be in the green, but it's not in dire straits at this point. What the commission can do, and I think is important for the commission to do, and in this rate case I think was helpful in fleshing out the commission's concerns, were we can't specifically tell them how to run their pension system. We don't run utility companies. But what we can do is say, look, in the future, unless changes are made, you can expect that the commission is not going to necessarily, as a matter of course, just pass along whatever liabilities may exist to the consumers. And so you need to understand that we're watching this, we're making note of it, and if proper changes aren't made to get the pension system in the shape that it needs to be, just know that this is going to be something that the commission will look at in future rate cases, and decisions will have to be made about what liabilities rightly belong to shareholders and what rightly belong to consumers.
Dale, if I could, there was a lot of things that came out during the rate case that were drinking about during the actual hearing itself and a lot of the discussion, where it became apparent that a lot of the things that our staff would have liked to have had during a rate case weren't not initially provided to our folks. And so one of the things the commission is looking at is almost like having a checklist of things that the company should provide us in a rate case, and making sure we have all the questions, all the information we have when our advocacy staff starts going through it. And even now, as we go through, our staff has an agreement with them, commitment to work on some of their accounting systems, how they're managing their different business lines, if you will. So there's a lot of good things that came out of it, but the pensions, I think, highlights some of the concerns that making sure that we understand what they're doing, so when we go into the rate cases, we have a beginning start line that we both agree on what should be included and how they're going to be managed.
Pension issues may actually be... And I think we may have talked about this at our work session, but pension issues may be something that would be useful to take up as part of a commission rulemaking, because this is not an issue that's specific to MDU. It's to any of the regulated companies, and I think it may make sense to just memorialize through a rule the lens through which the commission will be looking at issues like pension liabilities.
But is, I guess what I was trying to get at is there are ways that you could attempt to, well, let me put it another way. You can say to them, you can have a defined benefit plan, but you're only going to be able to charge this much of the defined benefit plan's cost to the ratepayers. Is that true?
Well, that'd be have to determine in a future rate case, but commissions, I think, are within their authority to take a look at those sorts of things and make a determination, basically looking back and looking over the utility shoulder. Look, you should have known at these mileposts that you had problems and they should have been addressed, and therefore the ratepayers won't be liable for them.
Well, especially now that the utilities that we regulate are on notice. You know, so, you know, they should not expect a ratepayer bailout of a disaster that we've now, you know, put them on notice to try to avoid. The best way to avoid the Public Utilities Commission is from micromanaging your company is to manage it well. You know, so realizing there are things that occur and happen that are somewhat unavoidable, we're in a situation, at least with MDU, where they are avoidable. So it was a very good discussion, and I think we can move forward with a clear understanding of what's to be expected.
I mean, what can you just tell me what the logic is of supporting, in a rate case, a company's defined benefit pension plan for its employees when this kind of plan is quite rare in the private sector?
Well, as I said, the issue that's to me the most important is what is the viability of the plan itself, and they do that through same actuarial studies that are done on any other plan. As I said, the assets that are available there are not in what you would term sort of red light area where there's an imminent disaster that's waiting to happen. I can't remember exactly what the liability to asset ratio is. There was one that we had asked about it through the course of the case, but it was for, and I can't remember if it was for the bargained or unbargained unit, but it was sort of in the yellow light area for one of them, where it was something you needed to address, it's something you need to shore up, and so it's something that, you know, they're on notice on, that they have to reform, and they have been doing so. Now, where I think a commission could come in and probably play an even stronger hand is if you started inching towards more of the real red zone area where you knew you had an imminent problem.
Dale, what I would say is that I don't think it's a commission's business to determine what the details of compensation are, including benefits, but rather whether the general compensation is appropriate and reasonable. Beyond that, it's up to the company to manage it. The point, I think, where we get into some difficulty is if as a result of, whether it's a result of management or a result of some economic downturn that creates a problem, then I think the question is appropriate. Is it the job, is it the responsibility of ratepayers to bail those decisions out or bail those circumstances out? So our job is not to micromanage how the compensation is done, but rather whether the overall compensation is appropriate.
The Elite case, could you please refresh my memory? What is the capacity of Bison 1 and Bison 2?
See, I was just thinking about this beforehand, and I thought I need
Bison
to jot
one
that down.
About
I think
80.
It's about, is it 70 or 80 somewhere?
It's up to, it was up to 80.9, I think. It went up after they...
This is Bison 1?
Yeah.
Okay. 80.9 megawatts.
Mm-hmm.
And Bison 2?
I think it's 105. But
are they both 105?
I think they are, but I'm not
sure. We need
certain.
To, yeah, we should
we
probably go back.
Verify those. I thought the same thing as you were reading that.
Yeah, I mean, just before it ran through my mind that I would fill those up.
And Bison 3 is what, please?
Bison 3 is 105.
Okay. Standard reason, all three the same.
And, all right, and the power line, can you tell me where that runs again, please?
The
Minnesota Power owns.
Oh, the DC line.
The DC line, yes.
The DC line runs from basically the Milton R. Young power station area to the Arrowhead of Minnesota. I don't know exactly where it ends near Duluth, but it's basically northeast Minnesota to center is the line. It's a bit unique, although not totally unique, but it's a bit of a rarity in that it's a DC line, not an AC line. The way to think about that is DC just basically transports the power straight from North Dakota and dumps it into northeast Minnesota. It doesn't connect anywhere else with the grid. AC, which is traditionally how utilities have transmitted power from one area to another and makes up the vast majority of the transmission system, is just part of the grid, and it has all sorts of network effects on the grid. But DC is, I heard someone describe it as the wormhole that just takes it from one spot right to the other, dumps it in. And
you know how much power loss they have as part of the journey?
DC, one of the nice things about it is it does cut down on line loss, and that's one of the reasons that some people are looking at it as a way to more favorably transmit power over longer distances.
You know, do you have any idea what their line loss is?
I don't, you know, from an engineering standpoint, I just know it's less, but I don't know the exact percentage.
Now, in the Verizon case, who has to approve your expense request?
District court has to approve that.
Okay.
North Dakota.
It's not the bankruptcy court?
I don't believe they. I think we're free and clear from that.
Okay. So the district judge approves your expenses?
Right.
Or not.
Yes.
We hope.
We hope, yeah.
The expense amount is a little larger than these things usually are. Is there a reason for that?
Well, the reason is because we've had a couple of reasons. We've had a number of insolvencies lately. So from a staff standpoint, we needed to procure some outside help. In addition to that, it's this was a complex case because it involved bankruptcy court, U.S. bankruptcy court. And so Doug Anderson from the Attorney General's office was providing us assistance. And so we get billed at the appropriate hourly rate.
And just so that I'm clear, the two claimants settled directly with the bonding company.
That's correct.
I don't recall that happening before. Is that a rare event?
I don't know if I can say it's ever happened.
First time?
Okay. Yeah. Sue's saying it's the first time, and certainly my time it's the first time. So it's it is a rare event. In this case, I suspect you'd have to talk to the bonding company and the claimants and find out exactly why. I would guess from their standpoint, they were able to get paid sooner. From the bonding company's standpoint, they were able to avoid some legal bills that would have accrued as this sort of went forward. So,
why do you think this doesn't happen more often?
I don't know.
The settlement issue? For one thing, I think this one wasn't perhaps quite as clear as some of them. You know, you remember some of the details of this case were somewhat unusual. So there might have, anytime there's a little bit of uncertainty on one side or on both sides, of course, it brings people to the bargaining table a little more rigorously.
One of the things we wanted to make sure we weren't doing, though, is giving any sort of sign that we're blessing the settlement that they came to. It's strictly between them, and their decision to withdraw is their own decision.
I also think, Dale, with regard to the request for expenses, you know, in a situation like this where none of that money would have gone to producers, it's a little, you know, feel a little more free to request it on behalf of the taxpayers as well, even though it's only $3,000.
I was interested in the colloquy about preferential laws that prefer or make it more difficult for a utility to make its resource plan throughout its territory rather than having state-specific situations. Mm-hmm. I mean, doesn't North Dakota have some of those laws? I mean, if the ADP law, if I'm remembering it correctly, it assumes that a project in North Dakota is prudent.
It presumes prudence, but it doesn't guarantee prudence. It also, incentives are one thing, but a mandate's quite another. And that's, I think, the difference. I mean, a mandate, and if you read the request for proposal that was issued by Montana Dakota, I mean, it's just so clear. But in terms of philosophical thing, it's one thing, like I said, to have some incentives in place. But in many cases, some of those incentives benefit an entire region, not just a state specifically. But a mandate is quite another matter. Because that throws out all of the other factors, such as low cost and common sense and whatnot, or at least it tends to.
Yeah, and North Dakota has been pretty good about not getting into the mandate business. To me, it reminds me a little of, remember the economic development wars of probably like the early 90s, late 80s?
Yeah, terrible.
where Kevin, you can tell us all about it.
Kevin was a soldier in the Mandate War.
No, I really was not.
States finally came to the conclusion of it was one of those games where the only way to win it is to not play it, because you couldn't keep on that treadmill. To me, mandates in the energy business, when you have interstate electric utilities and interstate energy companies, is another game. You can't play it, because at the end of the day, what it does is it drives up costs for everyone. Now, in this particular case, although I don't like the Montana laws, and although I think the procurement process was skewed because of that, I find that the end result still was reasonable, but it was in spite of that process, and I wish states wouldn't do it.
Well, at least we forget that a big thing that was resolved early in this case was the whole Big Stone 2 business about MDU as a company has a plan to develop, meet their generation needs because of some regional challenges. Big Stone 2 doesn't get built the way they had planned, and it changes a lot of the dynamics inside the company. I mean, it has far-reaching effects.
May I ask about Anexco? I didn't have they indicated, have they got a customer now?
Well, you know, they did talk about it at our hearing, the status of the issue, and basically what they said is that it's going to be a point of litigation between Anexco and XL. They are, I can't remember exactly what the status of it is, if they filed or not, but they gave us every indication that they plan on litigating that contract issue with XL.
I'll tell you, Dave, I did get a phone call from someone down there, asked how long our certificate's good for. It's good for 48 months. I didn't know that. But so there are a lot of folks that are thinking about how long it's good for.
Did Anexco say that when they're going to start construction?
They did not.
They implied that it would be held off. They actually implied that it would be held off until they could either resolve the litigation with XL or find a customer.
Did you get the idea just from how the project ended up being, or at least XL's participation in the project ended up being terminated, did you get the idea that the piping plover was a, pardon me for my mixed metaphor, but the piping plover was a fig leaf to get rid of the red herring, yes, to essentially get rid of an obligation that they did not want, because it seems as if the problem that XL Energy cited for deciding not to go ahead with this was one that was quite easily resolved.
Well, ultimately it was resolved, as a matter of fact. However, I'm not going to, I guess, judge what XL's motives were, but I would say this: if you put a calculator to it, this is a project that began a couple of years ago when the cost of these things was a lot more than it is today, and I think it was a $400 million project for 150,000 or for 150 megawatts. So $400 million for 150 megawatts is a very high capital cost by today's standards. So, you know, as an economic regulator of XL Energy, I guess, you know, we kind of look upon it with some. I look upon with some admiration.
I put it this way. I don't know, but I suspect that that's going to be the subject of the litigation, and I don't really want to be deposed, so I'm not going to say anything.
What is the status of the Keystone investigation?
Well, we're going to have a discussion about it, of course, at admin, and a person from PHMSA, from the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, will be on the phone with us to bring us up to date with it. They have, we've seen reams of questions and some responses that have been filed with us, and we'll be reviewing some of that at the admin portion of the meeting. But, you know, since, of course, that time, I received a phone call and an email a little over a week ago, I guess now time goes so fast, or maybe it was about a week ago, that there was yet another leak at another pumping station on the same line, this one down in Kansas, not nearly as severe a consequence because they leaked about, I think, 10 barrels as opposed to 400 barrels, but similar situation. It was a fitting, not the same fitting, of course, because those were all replaced, and it resulted in a corrective action by PHMSA. They shut the line down again. I think it's back up yet again, but it did require an even greater involvement by PHMSA. That, you know, we don't like to see these types of failures, but at the same time, I've never seen PHMSA this involved in any pipeline in our jurisdiction, and it's great to have their expertise, obviously. We're going to discuss it, like I said, at the admin portion and what if any, corrective action we're able to take.
Well, I would take, just Kevin pointed out that PHMSA's involvement, when Tony and I were at the National NARUC Conference, we had the Transportation Secretary, Mr. LaHood, talk about pipeline safety was now his priority. And so that would have been, when was that, January, February time frame we were out there? Mm-hmm. So I think clearly from their head all the way down, that PHMSA is taking a more active role in pipeline safety than they have in a long time.
Yeah, in fact, we're... as we may have talked about before, NARUC has a special task force that I appointed that is interfacing directly with PHMSA on these issues and includes some of the operators. And there's going to be a report coming out towards the end of the year. Cynthia Quarterman, who's the director of PHMSA, is going to be at our meetings in Los Angeles this summer to talk with us as well. So they're taking it very seriously. We are as well.
Do you think it's a fair point to use the problems of Keystone 1 to question the XL, Keystone XL?
Whether it's fair or not, it's inevitable that it's going to happen. And to the degree that you see problems on one pipeline, I think as regulators, you can't be blind to that fact, and you have to look at it in context of other pipelines that may go in.
Well, and certainly, I would think the pipeline itself, as it considers materials, as it considers construction companies, all of those things are going to take into consider, the same factors. So why wouldn't, I guess, environmentalists and regulators? I don't think that the EPA's objection to the XL is, however, as relevant in this situation, because the EPA, as you know, I saw the story today anyway, is continues to object to the XL, saying that it's environmentally not safe because of the toxicity of that particular oil, because of the carbon footprint. I suspect what they're talking about, of course, is the processing of the oil before it goes into the pipeline. But Tony's right. It's certainly inevitable, and it's being played.
Well, do you think it is a reason to not build the pipeline?
Well, people have to remember that pipelines are still the safest, right, most efficient way to move a product. And we have to constantly remind people of that. When pipelines have spills, they need to be taken care of. We need to do all the maintenance plan. But people can't lose sight that it's still the best way to move things. We have road concerns, safety concerns for trucking. If we're not building pipelines, those concerns are going to be bigger and bigger. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have the same scrutiny on pipelines as we do on everything else. So right now, I think that the industry itself has to make sure they're doing their due diligence, because regulators, you can trust that we're going to do ours. We can't let these things go on.
The Keystone represents over 700 trucks per day. When you put it in that kind of a perspective, significant.
I would think it's more than that. Only 700?
I think it was like 760 some day. But that's at the rate that we built it, or when it was originally sited. But
aren't you talking about close to 500,000 barrels a day?
Yeah, I think it was 535, as I recall. Does that sound about right, Scott? Is it my
700 trucks can carry 500?
760.
That seems a little low, because those smaller pipelines we've cited have taken 500 trucks a day.
Yeah. I was thinking it might be 7,000.
Maybe it is 7,000. We should look that up. It's in our order, actually.
What's the capacity of a pipeline truck, or excuse me, an oil hauling truck?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
Never mind.
All right. Yeah, I could find all that.
Annette, where are we at? We figured that out, you and I, the other day.
Okay. Any other questions?
Going once. Is anybody in the flood zone?
Twice.
My aunt is.
My brother-in-law, his wife, and my mother-in-law all were. They're not anymore. They're one's with us, and all their stuff is in our garage.
Is your mother-in-law with you, Tony?
All right, so my mother-in-law is with us, yes. And the other two have rented an apartment.
Scott's in the flood zone, though.
Right. Scott's in. Sue?
Sue, too?
Good.
Yes, so.
Okay.
Dave Thompson's in the flood zone, but he's behind a dike.
All right, if there's no further questions, we'll close this portion of the meeting, and we will come back in 5 minutes after order signing for our administrative portion of the agenda.